Oh my gosh, I've landed in 1907. It's the turn of the century here. We got the Industrial Revolution going on. We're right before World War I, which the U.S. kind of like, it seemed reluctantly got in. I'm not sure. Anyway, 1907, lots of great food and food things that we use today going on during this time, but also going on during this time, not email newsletters, which is what I want you to join on to. Go to the middle of our homepage, culinaryconvo.com, so you can sign up for the newsletter where we have our Pinterest recipes that we throw up there, as well as the social medias, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, doesn't matter. You can find us pretty much anywhere. Watch it on YouTube. That way you can see who these people are and what the foods look like and all those good things. I just appreciate everybody listening. It's been great. I would love to do a daily podcast. And so if you want to support the pod, go to anchor.fm/culinaryconvo1/support and you can support us. I'm trying to build a Patreon here, going through things, but we'll see how that goes. You guys will be the first ones to know, and especially those who sign up for the newsletter will be the first ones to know. But definitely check us out everywhere that you can. Follow us and rate us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just give us all the good ratings. I mean, if you give a bad rating, I might have to check it. I'm not sure. But the main thing is that you shouldn't be, because we're giving you all that we can. But 1907 will be right around the corner after a word from our sponsor. Welcome to Culinary Convo. I am your host, Devin Ream. The coffee is poured and your spot at the table is open. I've got my mise en place, and if your mind is open, let us begin. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Plate in Time 1907. I got Joel in the home studio wearing the merch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good old Biscotti's Pizzeria shirt. Yeah, look at that. Oh, yeah, buddy.
The low price of, I don't know how much. Shirt can be yours. It's also super soft. So.
It is. Very soft.
Yeah.
Many colors. He has the pink. It is quite nice.
Yeah.
You know.
Because I'm a man.
Yeah.
And real men wear pink. That's
real
what
men wear pink.
Guy at the grocery store told me yesterday.
Yeah. And he's right.
He is right.
You know? Like, wear
men
pink.
Wear pink. They wear cats.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. I am also lonely, so I might be a 50-year-old cat lady.
Ooh.
In disguise.
Oh, my God. Wouldn't that be a twist of events?
What a twist.
What a twist. But we've landed in 1907. Wonderful time period. Really. It's so fun.
Yeah.
It's great.
A very fun time. I'm jealous of the people in 1907.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It just reminds you how lucky we are today, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
The main thing that I know about 1907 is that it's in the 1910s.
The 1990s.
Jeez, the noughties. Yeah, the noughties. Yeah, I just made that up. Not the noughties, but the
1910s.
Yeah.
The O-10s there. The pre-10s.
But yeah. It's before, you know, World War One. The Industrial Revolution has occurred. Lots of workers' strikes and things going on.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Trying to get things better for working people. But it's still pretty, like, not much electric running through stuff, really.
They had really good quality houses.
Right.
That's
they
something.
Did.
Yeah. If you want to buy a house, make sure it's from, like, pre-1910.
Yeah. It's made of very thick
Those are
timber.
Actual good bones.
Right.
I mean, you're going to have to probably update the house a lot, right. But, right. You know.
No termites.
I mean, if it does, it's going to take a long time for the termites to do any damage.
Very true.
Which, they've had 100 years.
Right.
So you do need to get inspected.
Yeah. Always get the inspection.
That's good quality wood.
Good wood. Yeah.
Yep.
That's what you hope to hear every morning as you wake up in your home. That's a good wood.
Yeah, I hear it. It's like singing.
Yeah. But 1907, we're starting off here with Hershey's milk chocolate.
Yummy.
The Kisses were introduced. So Hershey's had been around, but now the Kisses are out. The top image with the boy and girl here showing the good old, like, here's this. And that's what the kiss came from, is you're supposed to stick it in instead of, like, oh, you're not going to actually kiss me. You'll kiss the chocolate. And that was, like, the tongue-in-cheek thing.
You should use a different vernacular. You're supposed to stick it in? That's not...
That's in not their mouths.
Yeah. Do that the next time you say that. In their mouths. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yep.
What? Was that bad?
What a great way of sharing mono.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ugh. I don't like it.
And, like, bugs legs. Like, clearly, we all know that thing, right?
I don't know. Maybe there were less bug legs in them back then.
Yeah.
I feel like now that'd be like, it's just they're in there so frequently because it's so processed.
Right.
Like, it's just, oh, pff, a couple of bug legs is fine. Whatever.
It'll be fine.
Roach has gotten the match. Woo-hoo.
Right. Ants outweigh people, so, like, of course they're going to be in there, right?
It's high-quality protein, too, really.
Totally.
When you think about it.
Yeah. Crickets, they're just noisy.
Oh, God. Oh, cricket leg and Hershey's Kiss. It's, like, folded up in there.
Is this the almond one?
God,
they're
no.
They're like, no, it's a Hershey Kiss.
Oh, like, no.
Oh, no. We have gone too far. But the next one here, Frederick Martin Sr. Look at that handsome man. Huh? Yeah. He's in Columbus, Ohio.
I can tell.
Yeah. He received a patent for a washboard. Yeah. An improved metallic plate having a series of staggered projections upon the face thereof.
I can't believe that they didn't have those beforehand.
Before 1907, right? Yeah. I imagine it like in the Civil War for some reason.
Yeah.
Like, but it's, yeah, like, I think they had wash, like, slates or like,
yeah, it was like just wood slats or something.
Yeah, but now, yeah, adapted for using a rubber plate.
Metal with holes in it.
Yeah,
genius.
Yeah,
great, your clothes, yeah. Awesome.
You think the Frederick Martin Senior like endowment and title and trust it probably is still going today? Old money.
Yeah. Yeah, I figured that somebody probably bought it.
Probably.
Yeah.
You would hope so.
And then it's like a complete waste of money now, but
yeah,
you still see a whole bunch of them in antique shops and stuff. Yeah. So.
And bluegrass bands.
His legacy lives on.
Right? Bluegrass
band? I don't listen to bebop.
Oh, you don't listen to the bluegrass bebop?
Bebop. Nope. Nope. All I know is electric trap music, you know, because it's very common and soothing.
It's soothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The bass, you know, it's really abrasive. Keeps your heart pumping when you're sleeping. Yeah.
That's what I have in my headphones as I fall asleep at night. Just, yeah. It keeps my heart in rhythm. You know? Yeah.
Without it, I don't think it would keep going.
Right. Right.
Pretty sure.
Couldn't keep living without it. But yeah, you got next year, John James McLaughlin of Ontario, Canada, is awarded a trademark for Canada Dry Ginger Ale. The champagne of ginger ale.
It's a strong word to be associated with ginger ale in any sense. Yeah. Champagne of ginger ale.
It's the champagne.
This is so good. It's on a whole other echelon of ginger ale. I'm like, I didn't know we were using measuring sticks in that.
Yeah. What's the whiskey of ginger ale?
Yeah.
Like, what's the, you know, like, well, Prosecco of ginger ale? Like, you know, I don't.
It's all kind of the same to me, I think.
I know. Yeah, I do love me a good ginger ale. I like ginger beer a little bit more.
Yeah.
It's, like, sharper. Ginger. Yeah. How is a beer stronger than ale is what I'm trying to decipher. I don't know how that works.
Yeah. I don't know, because, like, is it even, like, a measuring bit there, or is there, like, ale, beer, lager, like, you know, are those different?
Yeah. Like, ale is always, like, a little bit lighter, like pale ale, right? Like, there's that whole thing. Who knows?
So maybe that's why your ginger beer is sharper taste.
Probably. And I'd be drinking one in this hotel, very famous, It is the 18-story, 750-room Plaza Hotel, opened at the corner of Central Park South and Fifth Avenue in New York City.
Busy.
A little bit.
That's a lot of rooms.
Yes. Yeah. 750.
And it's right on Central Park.
Right on Central Park.
You want to guess how expensive that is?
Very expensive.
Yeah, really expensive.
It set the standard for luxury accommodation and service the moment it opened. Mr. and Mrs. Alfred Gwynn Vanderbilt were the first guests to sign the register.
That's what I think of when I think of 1907.
Yeah, the Vanderbilts.
Money. Old money coming from here.
Yeah. And it's kind of like an engineering marvel, too, for 1907, at least.
Yeah.
Like, 750 rooms, like, that is a old bugger.
That's,
you know,
big.
What I mean?
Like,
woo. But yeah, it had a history of the Plaza Hotel. I looked at a couple things on it. Some of the features on the outside are like they were specialty made for certain like guests that wanted their rooms to face like a certain way, like midday or away from the sun. And it's like, it's a hotel, not an apartment.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, why are you guys doing that?
But that's like, that old money. Just right. Like, I want what I want.
Yeah.
And you're going to give it to me.
I stay here 3 times a year. I want the window moved 7 feet. And it's like, okay.
I summer bird up here during summer. I come up here and...
I come up here to watch the ducks.
I enjoy the ducks in Central Park. Burr, burr, burr.
Yeah.
Yeah. Twitty.
But then, to not be outdone, the Ringling Brothers. They, yeah.
Never heard of them.
The Ringling Brothers Circus bought Barnum and Bailey Circus. That's right. The Barnum and Bailey brothers pictured here. All with the brown mustaches, and then Barnum and Bailey, the two people with the gray hairs. Yeah, it was like a big deal. It was basically them being like, oh my gosh, Barnum and Bailey is stopping, but Ringling has taken them. I think like circuses back then, you know what I equate it to? The WWE today. Like they didn't really have like a wrestling, they had boxing, but like...
Yeah. Well, just like the circus, you had, like, you know, all the freaks and cheeks of the circus all having, like, their own storylines that were being presented at these. So, I see where you could make that line. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And not only that, but then, like, the trained animals that were, like, a big deal. And they would try to act like, oh, yeah, this is the same elephant we've had for 40 years. And it's like, no, you've, like... shocked to death 18 of
exactly.
them. Like, we know you.
It's vaudevillian tradition to replace these things without anyone noticing.
Jeez.
I feel like this is definitely the beginning of the death of the vaudeville era in this time period as well.
Yeah. Well, and you have radio.
Yeah.
You've got movies, you know.
Radio killed the vaudevillian star.
Then the video came and made radio kind of dissipate but not go away.
That's in
We're
the
still
original
doing
song
it today.
And you're changing the lyric.
I know. I did it again. I'm sorry.
It's all about video killing the radio star. You could have just said that.
I know. I wanted to make it cool, and I didn't. But yeah, the next one here, 1907, Oklahoma became the 46th state. Can you believe that?
Oklahoma holding out.
Yeah.
And everyone's like,
what?
Who?
Yeah. Oklahoma.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah.
I wonder if there was like anyone be like, we got to get this product out of Oklahoma, but they won't become a state.
Like,
no, we don't want anything there.
I would have sworn, like, wasn't Missouri like 1848 or 38?
I don't know, but Missouri was like pretty early.
Right.
Because of St. Louis, really, being like the gateway to the West.
And independence being the jump off for the trail. Yeah. And that's the thing. I would have guessed like Oklahoma, maybe after the Civil War, 1870s.
Follow your sister state.
Right.
But no, Oklahoma was like, we're not doing it. We're not playing this game of big government. So they were holding out for... Almost 100 years later.
Tulsa and Oklahoma City ain't going to come up free. You understand?
And everyone else is like, we're not paying for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like, okay, then fine, we'll stay there. And then 1907 hits, and they're like, can we join your club?
We want to join that like 48 state thing.
Can we be in that, please?
Yeah. We really think we should join now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then it becomes a state, and Wilbur Olin Atwater died. No!
Who's that?
He was an American agricultural chemist who laid the groundwork for the science of nutrition.
So many chemists.
Yes.
Every single time we do these plate and times, it's just like all these awesome chemists that did this cool stuff.
I know.
I'm like, I know that there's cool chemists around now, but like they don't get any time to shine.
Yeah, they don't get any cred. So
like,
man.
Oh, they made this new medicine that doesn't really work, and you can pay thousands of dollars for it.
Right.
Kind of thing.
I know. In 1875, he established the first agricultural experimental station in the U.S. at Wesleyan College in Connecticut. Yeah. They're like, hey, Atwater, do you think you understand what the human health needs? And he's like, yes, I founded nutrition, and my name is Wilbur. They're like, we're not going to call you that. That's the name of a pig in a story, Charlotte's Web. We're never going to do it. And he's, yeah.
No, they're probably like, that name will go down in,
you
know, U.S. history. Yeah. And then it was just.
Nope. Yeah.
I don't know that guy.
Exactly. Yeah. He's like, Wilbur Atwater. This will be remembered forever. And then by like 1930,
on his deathbed, just,
I'll never be forgotten.
And then comes up on our podcast. I'm like, who is that?
Yeah. Who's Wilbur Atwater?
He's got a mustache.
Yeah. He looks fancy. Yeah. To be kind of outshined here, the thing that we still know today, besides Wilbur here, ink. Used on meat.
Oh.
Yes, that's right. Branding ink for use in meat inspection is developed.
Huh.
Yeah. I find it interesting that we don't talk about how we developed an ink that basically made it to where not only could we set a standard, but like it could be somewhat edible. Like if you ate it or a trace of it was on there, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And I think before then, a lot of people would have been like, impossible.
Like, I don't want to eat ink that comes from squids, and it's disgusting. It comes out of their cloaca.
Cloaca.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, branding ink. And then, you know, our homeboy up at the top, he was like, I am going to get the patent for the washboard. And then Maytag was like, hey, I'm going to introduce washing machines.
Yeah, exactly. So. That's how I feel. If anybody bought it, then it just wasn't going to be long-lived of success. Yep. Just, okay, well, you made a washboard for all the pores out in the boonies, but
basically,
now,
you know. People who didn't have electricity or running light, But Maytag washing machines are introduced. They were an addition to the farm implements the company produced in Newton, Iowa. They were produced during the seasonal slumps in farm implement sales. And it's made of wood. The whole thing's made of wood, and it's a little, like, turn thing. This gal basically pulls the lever. Yeah.
Can we go back to that design?
Yeah.
I know it's not like a big, you know, area, so you just have to do your clothes more often, but
right.
I could push that up, you know, 3 or 4 flights.
I could lift that with one shoulder.
I mean,
it'd be fine.
If it's made of wood, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it had a, it almost looked like a barrel. It had the metal like bands around it, you know. But Maytag was like, washboard.
Got a machine for that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the tractor.
Always automize. Everybody, everything. Go and buy a Roomba.
Yeah, buy a Roomba. Yeah.
Sponsoring the podcast today could be Roomba.
Roomba.
iRobot.
iRobot. Yeah.
But also, you're not, so.
Let AI clean your home so that it is clean to the naked eye. Thank you.
Don't give that away for free, Devin.
I'm not. That's patented by me right before Maytag
comes
and steals it.
Can't have
that
iRobot or Tubi Now Amazon. Sorry, Jeff. You're going to have to pay some money for that.
Sorry, Mr. Bezos. Yeah. Anyway, Gastronomy Pratique, or Practical Gastronomy, was published by Henry Babinski, nicknamed Alibab. So Alibab Gastronomy Pratique. So basically the first like actual like not cooking like recipes or receipts, but like technique of gastronomy.
Hmm.
Yeah. So
pretty useful.
Yeah, pretty interesting deal there. And then basically right after that, Mr. Kellogg said, you know what? I'm going to make paper freaking towels, man. And he did. He made, not really, it wasn't Kellogg. It was Scott Paper Company introduced the first paper towel. Kind of nuts. Basically, people at first didn't really want to use it because they thought it was very wasteful. And now we still kind of think that way, but we use them all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're wasteful, but they're useful.
They are quite useful.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, see, it's going to move on to Rachel Louise Carson. I must have had an image that was not a JPEG or something. I'm not sure. Mm. But one of the ad campaigns for Kellogg's Corn Flakes back in 1907. Mm. Back then, it was called the Battle Creek Toasted Corn Flake Company, offered a free box of cereal to every woman who would wink at her grocer.
I don't like this.
I think there was a reason why this ended.
Kellogg's is messed up.
Yeah, yeah. Like, because how did they get this agreement with the grocery stores to be like, well, if a woman winks.
You know, though, it was probably grocery stores filled with men.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'm freaking lonely as heck because I work in a grocery store in 1907.
Right.
And so they're just like, well, if you let these girls just take some of that for free as they give you a wink.
Yeah.
Ugh. I don't like that. Yeah. It's not a good energy. 1907, you got bad vibes.
I bet there were other grocers that, like, even though the ad campaign was over, they're like, come on, wink for me. And she's like, stop it.
And they're like, I don't want to. You're not going to give it away for free.
Yeah.
And you're like, I promise you, I'll give you a whole pallet full if you just wink at me one more time.
I'll give you a reduced price, please. Yeah.
Oh, creeps.
Yeah.
Bunch of creeps.
Creepy. Creepy grocers. But not today. They're still creepy.
Yeah, they're still creepy.
Anyway.
I mean, now it's just everywhere.
Right.
Maybe creepy all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. But Rachel Louise Carson may sound like a familiar name.
No.
She was born in 1907.
Pretty cool. Yeah. Congratulations.
Way to go, Rachel.
Good job. Yeah. We all do it.
We all do it. We all make it eventually somehow. We were the fastest swimmers.
Everybody gets born.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody who's anybody. Anyway.
Everybody who's anybody. Yeah, they're born.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Rachel Louise Carson, she was the author of Silent Spring.
An
American biologist. The book was concerned with the dangers of environmental pollution, especially DDT.
So she a cool lady.
Yeah, she a cool lady. She was slaying back then. She was like, DDT? No.
Boots the house down, Mama Queen.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going organic.
Okay.
Yeah, like this ain't happening the way you think it will.
She's probably ringing the bells being like, hey, we need to take care of our environment.
Yeah.
And people are like, nah, let's keep polluting the rivers.
Rachel, get a different haircut. Shut up. You know, and it was like, oh, wow. Okay, fine. But next, I mean, Rachel was born, so we have to taketh away. Elizabeth Cabot Agassiz. Yes, this fine, attractive young woman in these pictures. She
passed?
Yeah, she
did. Oh, God, what happened?
Yes,
I just heard.
I know.
I just heard. Elizabeth, I just heard.
Oh, my gosh, you're telling me for the first time. I can't believe this.
What'd she
do? She was an American naturalist. She co-founded with her husband, Louis Agassiz, the Anderson School of Natural History. Oh. She was also the first president of Radcliffe College. Yeah.
That's pretty cool, actually.
That is.
That they'd be like, let a girl do it.
Let a girl do it. Yeah, you want to be educated? Yeah, listen to her.
I mean,
you know?
Honestly.
Yeah.
The education system, girls are kicking its butt. They're doing way better.
Yeah. So. And then after she had been taken away, the world was like, we're going to give us again, and we got Orville Redenbacher.
He was born?
He was born. Yeah.
Old the guy Orville. That's on the front of the...
Yep.
Oh.
Yep. Gray-haired dude with the bow tie.
I know I've said it once before, folks, but this is the first time you're seeing me on flesh that I'm saying it. Don't put your face on your product.
Yeah.
It's gross.
Definitely.
Yeah, don't
like,
do it.
Like, don't ever, even if it's a cartoon.
No, we've covered this. If it's a cartoon, it's okay. Don't put, like, a rendition of your actual face, though, that looks like a painting or a picture. Don't do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
It's gross.
Because mine's pretty cartoon.
Orville?
You know?
He looks old and wrinkly. And he's like smiling, but I'm like, the teeth are fake, obviously, because he's been eating corn his whole life.
Yeah. He's been shucking shells left and right. Yeah. You know what I mean?
You don't keep your teeth from shucking.
You know, it makes me wonder, though, did he have game? You know what I mean? Did Orville have game?
I bet as soon as his popcorn industry lifted off the ground, he had game.
He had game. Yeah. He would walk into a boardroom, do his meeting. Yeah.
Money.
He'd come out and he'd be like, well, all the movie theaters keep buying all my seeds here.
They keep buying the corn, and so I just keep farming it up.
Yeah. Heard old Kellogg was trying to do wink at a grocer, but if you wink at me, I'll just give you a little tub of popcorn. Yeah, see, that sounds creepy.
Yeah.
That's why you don't say stuff like that.
1907, full of old creeps.
Full of old creeps.
Really important women being born and dying, and then creepy men.
Orville could have been a very nice guy.
He could have been. I'm slandering the dead right now. We know that for sure. But you know what?
Yeah.
Orville Redenbacher, come after me. Try and stop me.
Try to stop me, Orv.
You can't hit me. You know why? Because I don't know what I'm talking about.
Exactly. And guess what? I'm man enough. I'll apologize.
I'll apologize for a sponsorship deal.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, oops, sorry. Can you support us on Patreon? Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, but not to be outdone, Earl S. Tupper was born.
From like Tupperware? Okay. Inventor, I'm following along. I've got the idea now.
Tupperware, yeah.
Tupperware is pretty great. So. Yeah. I mean, plastic pollution, but they're really useful yet again.
The person who did the timeline here, they put Tupperware makes the containers used to conduct mold and bacterial experiments in the back of refrigerator shelves. Slandering a product. Yeah, that was foodreference.com. So they tried to put a little funny in there.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to lighten
it up. We didn't say that. So Tupperware, don't come after us. Tupperware, don't come after us. But also, support the Patreon if you like.
Yeah, if you like to. Yeah, go ahead.
Or buy some of these.
Yeah, buy the shirt. Yeah. Buy our merch stickers. We got stickers like crazy.
Buy the merch.
Magnus.
Orville Redenbacher, instead of giving us a lifetime supply of popcorn, please just buy some teas.
Yeah. Yeah. Buy teas for your whole company, Orville.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what you should do.
They're comfortable enough.
They are. Yeah. They're very soft. They're very nice, very soft.
I'm loving it.
They are great. Yeah. And then the last one here from the food reference. The Times introduced the New Year's Eve ball. Yeah, on their building at Times Square.
Really?
Yeah,
in 1907 was the first year for that. That's a big one.
I know.
We're ending it on a big one.
Yeah, and speaking of a big one, descending to mark the end of the old and beginning of the new year ever since, the iron and wood ball was 5 feet in diameter, so it's like, okay, size of a person-ish, and weighed 700 pounds.
Wow.
Whoa.
Just over me. Just barely.
Just a smidge over
just
my
a smidge
weight.
Over. Can't believe it. You almost got it right.
Almost got it right.
Yeah. The Times Square ball is actually modeled after yours truly.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I was about to say this shirt's hugging my middle section a lot, but I think that might be user error.
Yeah. Whoa.
That's just because I'm modeled, that Times Square ball.
Yeah. Times Square
700
ball.
700 pounds and counting.
And counting. And then to kind of take a look at an archived book here, this is a guide to modern cookery by none other than Escoffier.
Escoffier.
Yeah. This was in 1907. This was like the deal, man. Look at that. Library of the New York State College of Home Economics.
People could read in 1907?
Dude, I was shocked too. Yeah. it's crazy. And it's part of the Cornell University Library.
Oh.
Look at that. There's people writing in cursive. Nobody does that anymore.
People had pens?
Yeah.
Biro?
What? Yeah, look at that guy.
That's a hell of a mustache. Yeah. That is great.
Yeah, Escoffier was like, look at these handlebars, ladies.
Yes, I can hold on for days.
But yeah, the main thing with that, it has the fundamental elements. So fonds de cuisine, the leading warm sauces. So you have your five mother sauces that come out of this. All those things, it basically set down the groundwork for a lot of like your culinary institutions today.
And then we've expanded on that since then. But he's part of history.
Yeah.
He's part of history, you know?
Pretty cool.
Yeah. And Escoffier, he did not create this, but foodtimeline.org was like, hey, we remember 1907, and we were making Divinity Fudge. Yeah. Divinity Fudge.
Sounds divine.
Yeah. Although recipes for various nougat and sweet meringue type confections with and without nuts and fruit can be traced to ancient Turkish and 17th century European roots, food historians generally agree that Divinity, a.k.a. Divinity Fudge and Divinity Candy, is an early 20th century American invention. Why? One of the primary ingredients in the early Divinity recipes is corn syrup.
Something that would curse America for the rest of its time.
Yeah. It is a product actively marketed to and embraced by American consumers as a sugar substitute at that time. Whew. Yeah. Corn syrup was affordable, economical, practical, it was shelf-stable, and adapted well to most traditional recipes. Caro brand, which is still, like, super popular today, introduced by the Corn Products Refining Company in 1902, was or is perhaps the most famous. It is no coincidence that early Caro cooking brochures contain recipes for Divinity. Food historians have yet to determine the first person to call this delicious confection Divinity. The general consensus about the name? The finished product tasted divine. A survey of American cookbooks confirms recipes for Divinity Kennedy fudge rolls were standard items from the 1930s to the present. Some people connect Divinity with Southern roots. This is not confirmed by our cooking texts, which are published all over the country. Perhaps Divinity with pecans is a Southern twist on a national favorite. But back in 1907, for the Christmas cheer as ever calls on the housewife for sweets, pies, and all the rest of the good things of the holidays, and the New York Times said, in place of the time-honored fudge, she may make the new Divinity Fudge, a sweet that is no more expensive, that takes but little more time, but that is far more delicious. Melt a cupful of sugar in a saucepan. When melted, pour it on another saucepan, in which there is already a cupful of cold milk. Put this pan onto the fire and cook slowly until the two have blended. Then add two or more cupfuls of granulated sugar and one more cupful of cold milk and reheat, cooking slowly until it is a proper consistency to remove from the stove. At this time, add a heaping teaspoonful of butter and a cupful of finely chopped nut meats. Beat the mixture with a large spoon until almost cold. Then spread it over buttered pans and line for cutting like fudge.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all.
Rock on.
Yeah, that's it. Divinity fudge, perfectly made after you do all that.
Yeah, remember all of that, yeah. Folks. And if you have to, you can go back and...
Right, you can hit rewind. Yeah. I believe on Spotify it's 15 seconds or 10 seconds. You can just keep hitting back.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're going
to
get it.
You're going to have to, because it sounds like as she kept going, she was having more and more of the corn syrup poured down her mouth.
Right, yeah. Guys, remember, there was a lot of mercury in hats back then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
So, beaver pelts, all sorts of stuff. It was weird.
Undiagnosed ADHD.
Oh, my God. Rampant. Especially at the New York Times. I mean, my gosh. But, yeah. The next one here, sauerkraut candy. Oh, man. What a delicious treat.
It's disgusting sounding.
What? No. It's sauerkraut candy. Yeah. Sauerkraut candy. Confectioners are brilliant when it comes to creating novel items. Some pieces are highly crafted. Others are assembled with cheap ingredients to feed a popular frenzy. Sauerkraut candy is a little bit of both. This particular confection combines coconut and sugar to achieve a product that looks like sauerkraut. So it's not actual sauerkraut. Right?
Ugh. I don't like anything trying to be... anything like sauerkraut.
I mean, you know. But why on earth would someone invent this? We wondered too. Food historians confirm coconut, aka cocoa nut, has been a popular ingredient in American foods from colonial days forward, because we could get them from, you know, coconut trees. Fresh, dried.
Cheap labor.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah, that too. Fresh, dried, or desiccated coconuts-flavored American desserts. Survey of newspapers throughout the American Midwest, so Wisconsin and Iowa in the early 20th century found it. This region was home to great waves of Northern European immigrants, an inexpensive novelty confection resembling beloved sauerkraut and promoted as such makes perfect sense in this context. And also German chocolate cake. It's just a chocolate cake with coconut on it, and it's like, what's going on with that? And it's like, oh, because of the German Midwest.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but it does say here, it isn't quite the whole story. They do say there was a Greek factor. They said our survey revealed two articles connecting a Greek confectioner with sauerkraut candy. So maybe the Greeks made it, and we don't know. It says here that a Greek employed in the making of sauerkraut candy at Milwaukee has been forbidden to continue his business. He is a victim of tuberculosis.
What?
Yeah, he's a victim of
tuberculosis. Said that in what?
In Eau Claire Leader.
Eau Claire Leader?
Yeah, Wisconsin, April 19th, 1907. Yeah. And then it says, try sauerkraut candy to make you thrive. 10 or cents worth.
To give you tuberculosis is what I'd be reading from that.
Yeah. What? 10 cents worth, and you'll bet your money's worth. The county fair in the Baltimore Sun reprinted in the Ackley World, October 2nd, 1907.
Hmm.
Yeah. And then also through foodtimeline.org, aioli.
Yum.
Aioli.
I like this. I'm a fan.
Aioli. Aioli.
Maybe not quite that big of a fan, but I do like it.
Aioli.
Yeah.
Aioli is what happens when garlic marries mayonnaise. Simple, delicious, tangy, and divine. Originally meant to accompany cod, like delicious.
Yeah.
This traditional Provençal sauce pairs remarkably well with eggs, meats, and starchy vegetables. Aioli peaked mainstream American palates after World War II. True Spanish or Catalan aioli is slightly different. It does not contain eggs, so it's actually like vegan vegetarian somewhat. Historic notes and vintage recipes are here. Aioli are beurre de Provence. You're supposed to pound 1 ounce of garlic as finely as possible in a mortar, add one raw egg yolk and a pinch of salt while gradually filling it up with oil. But yeah, this makes a mayonnaise along with your garlic. It's aioli.
Yeah,
Bob's your uncle.
Good stuff.
That was through Le Guide Culinaire in Escoffier.
Le Guide Culinaire.
Yeah. First translation into English in 1907. There's our buddy Escoffier again. Showing up. Doing what he can. Yep. He's like, oh, I'm going to make the whole basis of all culinary industry. And also, aioli. And everybody's like, great.
Thanks. I love it.
Yeah.
Aioli's good.
He did good stuff. The next one here, you have Gargiulos. Yeah.
I'm not sure that's the way that's pronounced.
Gargiulos?
I don't know.
I'm guessing it's Gargiulos.
Something like that. And it's an Italian restaurant. So.
Yeah, it's an Italian restaurant established in 1907 in Coney Island, Brooklyn, and New York City. The restaurant was started and run by Gus Gargiulo. Yeah. And later he was joined by his brother, Louis, and sister, Luis, one or the other, and sisters, Tessie and Angelina, with other family members working in the kitchen. Large parties were often held in the spacious dining room with its large maroon drapes, and the parties often spilled out onto the small courtyard in the back in the warm days. The warm days? The warm days.
The warm days.
That's now, folks. Pictures of these parties line the walls in the entrance hall, many with recognizable faces such as Jimmy Durante. That's right. Yeah. So Gargiulos was like Jimmy Durante's second home, which is not what it says here, but that's what I'm taking from it.
Yeah.
You know? But anyway, the next one here, one that I had never heard of, but now I want to go to just for the heck of it, just to say I've been there. Kuopi, I believe is how you pronounce it. I have no idea. It's in Finland, everybody. Kuopi, or the Finnish pronunciation. Yeah, you want to read that, Joel?
I can't read it.
Yeah, it's Kuopi.
Kuopi.
Kuopi. It is a restaurant in Iisalmi, Finland. According to Guinness World Records, it is the smallest restaurant in the world. Yeah, the building has a footprint of eight meters squared.
Square.
Which is 86 square feet, which is 4 square feet smaller than my dorm room in college.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's about as much house as I can afford.
Right. Yeah. That's about, yeah. Of which 3.6 meters squared, or 39 square feet, is indoors. So the rest of it's outdoors. Yeah.
I wouldn't say that's
a restaurant.
Part of the restaurant. Yeah. I would say that restaurant is 3.6 meters squared.
Right. Right. Yeah. The building housing the restaurant was constructed in 1907 as a cabin for Finnish State Railways, now VR Group, track inspectors to rest in, and it was later moved from its trackside location to its current place. It was named Corky for a long time. Inside the building is a bar, a television, one table for two people, and a toilet. The interior of the restaurant is fully licensed to serve alcohol and can seat two people in addition to a waiter. There is also a small terrace outdoors. In late May 2020, there was an announcement that because of the COVID-19 restrictions, only one customer could enter the restaurant at a time in early summer 2020.
What a difference.
Yeah. Ooh, it couldn't have.
Yeah.
Yeah. The terrace could still seat two customers, as terraces were free of customer limit restrictions.
Because they were outside.
Yeah. The name of the restaurant, Kuoppi, means cupboard in English. The actual word in Finnish is kaapi, but the double vowel AA tends to morph into a ua, so Kuoppi, in Slavonian dialects. I'm guessing that was Slavonian or whatever.
Yeah.
Hence, kaapi becomes Kuoppi. But yeah, smallest restaurant in the world.
Hmm.
I'm going to go there and be like, hey, I want a beer. And then I'll be like, that is the smallest restaurant in the world. And everybody's going to be like, Devin, nobody cares. Like, my God, why do you do this? Why'd you travel to Finland, waste how much jet fuel to get there just so you could eat at the smallest restaurant? For a good time. Yeah. And I'm like, I wanted a good time, guys. Yeah. That's all I wanted. It was a good time. Leave me alone. Let me go to Kuoppi. And they are like, no, Devin, this is a mental hospital. And you can't leave on your own.
You're there, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, not really. I wouldn't know. I can't say that, I don't think, that I've lived in that. I haven't. I'm just saying. I would be crazy to think that I should just take one trip to go there, is what I'm trying to say. Hey. Anyway, per the Wikipedia, this was another restaurant that was established. Varallo's, and I've heard of this place, not rave reviews, but anyways, it is the oldest restaurant in Tennessee, founded as a chili parlor by Frank Varallo Sr. in 1907. From 1994 to 1998, there were two locations. Frank Varallo Jr. took over from his father in 1929, and a second Varallo's was opened by his two grandsons.
Todd and Tony.
Near the entrance to the Nashville Arcade on 4th Avenue, Frank Varallo Jr. closed his Church Street location upon his retirement in 1998 at the age of 85.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Time well spent. You got to retire at 85.
Ooh. Hey, he liked what he did. He was selling chili, you know? He was like, chili, arcade, love it. This is great.
The American dream, folks.
Yep.
And then, 85.
And then his grandkids were like, hey, so how much money did you make? He's like, I don't know. You need to open another location.
He'd be like, I don't know. I can't remember anything. I'm dementic.
I've had a lot of lead paint.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
A lot of lead paint, a lot of asbestos.
Well, Varallo family, if he was a really nice guy and awesome, you can, you know, send us a message.
What are you talking about? He's still alive. We didn't talk about his death, did we?
Well, we didn't, but 1998 and he was 85.
He could be 120, you don't know.
Varallo family, you have to keep us up to date. CulinaryConvoPod@gmail.com. Also,
yeah, follow us
on social media.
Support the Patreon, buy some t-shirts for your great grandpa.
Yeah, please follow, like, subscribe, punch the notification bell.
Ring make that sure,
bell. Yeah, make sure to send stuff at culinaryconvo.com. Visit the merch shop, but we're not done yet. Blue Bell Creameries. That's right. Established in 1907. Very popular in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Blue Bell. It's an American food company that manufactures ice cream. It was founded in Brenham, Texas. Or Texas.
Texas.
Yeah. For much of its early history, the company manufactured both ice cream and butter locally. In the mid-20th century, it abandoned butter production and expanded to the entire state of Texas and soon much of the southern United States. The company's corporate headquarters are located at the Little Creamery in Brenham, Texas. Since 1919, it has been in the hands of the Cruz family. As of 2015, Blue Bell was the number two selling ice cream manufacturer in the United States. Number two. Yeah. Kind of crazy that they're number two, but I understand.
They're in Texas.
Yeah, they're in Texas. Probably
irks them.
Yeah.
I can't believe we're in Texas. We're number one, but we're number two.
But we're number two. And that happened. Yep. And then, yeah. They go to watch their favorite team, the Longhorns, and they are bleh. And then they go and they're like, well, maybe we can go to a governor's rally, and they have Abbott. Yeah, so no, it's all there. Yeah, and then they can't even go because their electrical grid's out. I don't like Texas. That's what I'm trying to say. I don't know.
Some issues.
They have some issues. It's a wonderful place with wonderful people, but there's a lot of things that need, you know, fixing. Not
speaking
that
of issues, yeah. The next thing is headquartered in a place that also has some issues, but different issues.
Yeah. Faygo. Yep. Blueberry Faygo. That was a song not too long ago, I think. I can't remember.
Yeah, back in 1907. Not too long ago.
No. It was a song. It was Blueberry. Oh, my God. Kaylee logged into my Spotify.
Yeah.
And now I can't even. Oh, my God. My God.
I can't believe she did that when you were recording your podcast. That's crazy.
Probably. Yeah.
Maybe she's just trying to keep you on task.
Anyways, but yeah, Blueberry Faygo, it was a big song not too long ago. But anyways, Faygo Beverages is a soft drink company headquartered in Detroit, Michigan. They've got some issues, as we've seen. Yeah, the beverages produced by the company, branded as Faygo or Faygo Pop, are distributed in the Midwestern and Mid-Atlantic and Central Southern regions of the United States, as well as Southern and Western Canada. Faygo Beverages is a wholly owned subsidiary of the National Beverage Corporation and started in Detroit, Michigan in 1907 as the Fagenson Brothers Bottling Works.
Mm.
And then went to Faygo. Mm. Pretty interesting. And then the next one here, Morelli's Gelato.
Does Alex have something
I to know. With this? That's why I added this. Buddy of the pod, Alex. Yeah. Is he a gelato magnate and we don't know?
Like, if he is, why? Don't keep that a secret.
I know.
From us,
don't
man.
Keep that from us. We need more gelato and we need money.
Yeah, I just need your money, money.
Your movie.
Oh, aren't you? Yeah. We're best friends, aren't we, Alex?
We're mid buddies. Yeah. But it is a producer and retailer of ice cream. The company was founded in 1907 by Giuseppe Morelli. What a name. Giuseppe Morelli.
Giuseppe.
Yeah. Initially, he sold ice cream from a bicycle with his son, Mario.
These are like really stereotypical Italian names. Morelli's, Giuseppe, Mario.
Yeah. As the business grew, an ice cream van was used. In 1932, an ice cream parlor was opened on the seafront of the seaside resort of Broadstairs. In addition to luxury gelato, which is produced fresh every day in every store, Morelli's Gelato also served their own blend of Kilimanjaro coffee and their signature elaborate retro sundaes. Morelli's has also featured many times in TV and films such as Mary Berry, BBC's The One Show, and The Lady in the Van. It has also been voted number one of the 5 best ice cream parlors in the UK by The Telegraph.
Huh.
Yeah, top 10 by The Times and Stylus Magazine, as well as some of the best gelato in London and the best ice cream in Britain by Condé Nast Traveler. What? The heck? Alex has been hiding a secret from us for this long.
First off, he's British.
Yeah, exactly. He's been taking trips to London without our knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they were on private planes, so we wouldn't have known.
We wouldn't have known. We wouldn't couldn't even get the manifest for that, no. I bet.
We could track it on Twitter through a bot.
That's how we follow our friends now, is yeah. Twitter bots.
I only follow Jeff Bezos, Kim Kardashian, Taylor Swift.
Wow.
Elon Musk. Just the big people that really have like a lot of the private jets.
Right. RuPaul. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah. She's just going to go and frack a little bit more. That's all.
Oh.
Don't meet your heroes.
Don't meet your heroes. Unlike Purdy's chocolate, you can meet Purdy's chocolate. Purdy's chocolatier. You're
heard with Purd.
Yeah, with Purd. Yep. Purdy's Chocolatier is a Canadian chocolatier, confectionery manufacturer, and retail operator. The company is based out of Vancouver, British Columbia, on the west coast of Canada, from its 57,000 square foot factory.
Wow.
Yeah, Purdy's produces a variety of different chocolates and confectionaries that are distributed to all of its retail locations. These products include a variety of specialty chocolates, including truffles, hazelnut hedgehogs, caramels, creams, molded filled chocolates.
They do chocolate.
They do chocolate.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do a lot of chocolate. Hey, did I mention they did chocolate?
They do chocolate.
They do chocolate. Purdy's Chocolatier, guess what? Does chocolate.
They do a lot of different kinds of chocolate.
Yeah, yeah. So that's 1907. That's all the places.
Woo!
Yeah, all the things, all the places. For your plate, lots of desserts.
Yeah.
Yeah, most
things
desserts.
Comes in line with, like, the industrialization factor, yeah. Where they're just like, oh my god, corn syrup, we could put that in everything.
Yeah, sugar, more.
Wow.
Yeah.
People
love sugar. We don't know why.
Maybe it's as addictive as cocaine. I don't know.
We put that in our soda.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I mean, you know, 1907... crazy times, the start of a gelato empire that we didn't know about.
A time with like a lot of change going on.
Yeah, definitely. Not only that, but like in Europe, it seemed like there was a lot of like knick-knacky type stuff, like the kuapi and the, like, you know, it's like, hey, we're going to make weird stuff. It was kind of that way. Like, it was like, you know. Who knows? We're in a pretty mellow time right now, and we're like, don't look ahead.
Yeah. Enjoy it while you can,
yeah, enjoy
babe.
It while it lasts. But next time on Plate and Time, we're going to 1952.
1952.
Yeah.
The beginning of the end, they say.
The beginning of the end. 1952. Yeah. 1952, you can see in the bottom right corner there, the Queen... Yeah, I knew that. That was the most recent thing I've heard of 1952.
Yeah.
That was when the Queen Elizabeth was, you know, what do they call that? Like anointed or what?
Crowned.
Crowned, yeah. Queen of England after her father's passing. But yeah. Yeah, I bet it's going to be a good time.
Look to it. Look forward to it.
Yeah, I bet Kaylee's going to want to hop on that one. Yeah. Because she's a... what do they call it? Mid-century modern. She likes a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
So she's going to probably be like, well, not only was the Queen crowned, I'm going to be like, Kaylee, please. People need to understand what's going on with food. She's like, but the Queen! I'm like, okay, hold on. Yeah, but no, she'll be around probably. But 1952, we'll see everybody next time. Joel wearing our merch shirt. He's killing it with the Benicio's Pizzeria in pink. And Joel's in our home studio. Thank you for joining. Look at that flare, everybody. And you can watch us on YouTube. Ooh, look at that. You can see the sex appeal that we've got on screen here. Mm-hmm. Along with
cats. I'm available
cats.
For appointments.
Ooh, appointments. Yeah. Hey.
Pay me and I'll show up to places.
And yeah, we'll see everybody next time. Visit culinarycombo.com. Listen to us, rate us, subscribe, follow, do all of that. We'll see everybody next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
Yeah, yeah. Goodbye. This episode of Culinary Convo was written, produced, edited, and created by yours truly, Devin Rehm, as a part of Mouthful Productions. Please check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at Culinary Convo, and our website, culinaryconvo.com, for recipes, episodes, resources, and send an email to culinaryconvopod@gmail.com with your fan suggestions or recipe submissions. You can also support the podcast by going to anchor.fm/culinaryconvo1/support so we can purchase cooking or audio equipment to help create a better podcast, or by using the funds to help further the exploration of Culinary Convo by ordering subscription boxes, food kits, or ordering food products to review. So shout out to our first supporter, Convonaut Dylan. Thank you. I also want to give audio credit to Soundtrap for our intro, transitions, and outro music. Thank you.